Radio Free Press, a podcast from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
Not since the wage restraint of the 1970s or the mass redundancies of the 1980s has there been the real prospect of coordinated withdrawal of labour by the trade union movement in Britain. But such is the level of opposition to cuts in public services, changes in employment conditions, and the loss of pension rights that the coalition government might well be on the point of provoking a demonstration of industrial action of a kind not seen for 30 years. Plans are already in train for a possible mass walkout on Thursday, the 30th of June. More than a million union members, including teachers, university lecturers, tax officers, and countless other public sector workers, are due to take part. But a lot has changed since the rolling strikes of the 1970s and 80s. The union movement faces not only much tougher legal restraints than in those earlier years, but also a far different and potentially more hostile media environment. Any mention of strike action produces predictable knee-jerk headlines about a winter, or perhaps a summer, of discontent, and another outing for those grainy old photographs and television footage of rubbish piling up in the streets. We've already had a taste of the kind of coverage that we can expect following the warning by the business secretary, Vince Cable, that if there is coordinated strike action, it might lead to tougher trade union laws. Now with me are three people who speak up for the trade unions and who seek to communicate on behalf of their members. Jeff Martin, Sean Jones and Francis Beckett. First, the question uppermost in the minds of the unions today, how will the media respond if there is coordinated industrial action in the face of cuts in public services? Jeff Martin, you're a press officer for the largest rail union, the RMT. Now, I knew you way back when you were a union activist yourself, only too prepared to speak up for the unions. How do you think the media are going to respond if there is coordinated industrial action?
Well, I think we can expect a hostile response. I think we've already seen that. I think that we're paying a price for the fact that the media is sensationalist, that they look for the cheap and easy option, the snappy headline, and just kind of lazy journalism in a way. There isn't much in-depth reporting of what the real issues are. I mean, they're much easier to go for the kind of soft touch. And I think part of the problem is that there is just a dearth of people who actually understand how the trade union movement itself works and what it is that we're seeking to do. We're here to actually represent our members. We're here to get a better deal for our members. We're here to protect our members' jobs and the services that they work in. A trade union that didn't do that and didn't try to articulate that wouldn't be worth having.
Sean Jones, you're the press officer for the Communication Workers Union. Do you think, as your union, of course, knows only too well the prospect of change that's now facing the postal business, for example, as you know only too well, it can be difficult to get your case across. What do you think are the chances of the union movement being heard in the current media environment that Jeff Martin's just been describing?
Well, I mean, I completely agree with Jeff's comments, and I think actually the strike story is exactly what journalists want to hear. Journalists love strike stories. It's that kind of obvious story about trade unions, and it, in many ways, having a strike plays directly into the media's hands because it's an easy way for them to tell a story about trade unions. And actually, it's very difficult to get media coverage unless you have a strike ballot. People aren't interested. So the question that I'm constantly asked by journalists is, okay, so you oppose privatisation of the Royal Mail, are you going to go on strike? And so they're immediately pushing you into that corner of trade unions being militants, trade unions being only effective if they take strike action. So I think actually we play into a kind of easy media agenda by taking strike action. I'm not saying it's wrong, and I think trade unions absolutely have to be standing up for their members. And at the moment, the attacks we're seeing across the board are terrifying. And the results we're getting amongst my own membership at the CWU for returns to strike ballots are, you know, kind of 9-1 in favour of strike action where they're being held. So there's very strong feelings across the board.
Francis Beckett, until recently you were the spokesman for the Fire Brigades Union. Now that's a union which has been, if I may say so, has been very successful in presenting itself in some very tough, bitter industrial disputes over the years. What do you think now are the chances of the union movement being heard today?
I've found it harder than I've ever found it before with the fire brigades union to get fair and decent media coverage, far harder than I did 20 or 30 years ago when I was involved with other trade unions. And I think one of the main reasons is that although in the end newspapers are bound to oppose trade unions taking industrial action, they always have, they always will, because a trade union taking industrial action is necessarily in opposition to the establishment, and the newspapers must and do represent the establishment. They're bound to oppose us. They do so, I think, a little more vigorously and a little more openly and a little more crudely now than they ever did before. We'll come on, no doubt, to the reasons for that. But I just want to give you one example of that. You remember that the Fire Brigades Union had a strike in London last year. I struggled to get any mention of the reasons for the strike into the newspapers. It was an enormous uphill struggle to get anybody. Some newspapers, to their credit, did do it. One newspaper actually sided with us. But everything seemed uphill from our side, from our point of view, and the vast media operation mounted by the London Fire Brigade, on the other hand, had a much fairer and much easier task in getting their point across. And I just finish with this one story that we had on the first day of the strike, and everybody had been predicting that there would be an enormous amount of violence on the picket line, and of course there wasn't, because the Fire Brigades Union is a remarkably disciplined organisation. Firefighters are by their nature very disciplined, and if told by their leaders, no, you are not going to attack people, you are not going to do any of these things, they don't do them, and they didn't do them. The report on ITN's London Tonight that night started off, was all about there will be violence on the picket lines. Is there going to be violence on the picket lines? The story was whether there had been violence on the picket lines, mm-hmm. And the background, the sort of moving wallpaper, if you like, was queue footage of Wapping. This is so extraordinarily lazy. I mean, Wapping had about as much to do with the firefighters' strike in London last year as you might as well have said queue footage of the 1926 general strike, for all the relevance that had. It was one of the crudest things I've ever seen. And all it seemed, I don't think this was done deliberately in that sense, but all apparently done to disguise the fact that all the violence that they had been predicted from firefighters never happened. It's not very well known, incidentally, that there was violence on the picket lines in that particular strike. The secretary of the Fire Brigade Union in London was run down by a fire engine driven by a striking firefighter, and another official of the union was knocked down by a car driven by a manager. These things were not reported an awful lot.
Sounds to have been some pretty graphic example there of what can happen during industrial disputes. Jeff Martin alluded to the fact that, of course, there were days when there were more labour and industrial correspondents. Now, Sian Jones, you're perhaps not as familiar as some of the older members of this group might be with those days. How, and you said that you found that the media just had a knee-jerk reaction. Is it really difficult for you to get across a positive story?
Well, I mean, I would say even within the time that I've been doing media relations, what we found that a whole raft of especially national industrial correspondents have either taken early retirement or who have left. We've had Andy Taylor from the Financial Times, John Willman from the Financial Times both leave. We've had Stephen Cape from the BBC take early retirement. Christine Buckley from the Times was very controversially sacked. And luckily was represented very well by her union, the National Union of Journalists. And there was a long period of time where the Times didn't have an industrial editor. They do now in Robert Lee, and he's finally getting stories about the Royal Mail and post offices back into the pages of that newspaper. The Guardian, Mark Milner left, took early retirement. We've really struggled to get decent coverage in the Guardian of all papers, which you would think would actually give us a fair showing. And we have really struggled. And that's just within my experience in the last kind of 4 or 5 years of dealing with these people. So I think the lack of understanding, I think the biggest challenge that I face, I'm sure a lot of trade union press officers face, is getting people to phone you in the first place and understanding that what trade unions do, because we're only getting phoned when there's a strike going on. And we're constantly proactively calling out there. But if there's a story coming up, perhaps a story about a company that may be interested in buying Royal Mail, if the journalist, perhaps a fairly newly trained journalist, is writing that story, they might not understand that there is a trade union representing the views of the people who work in that industry and who they should be quoting in that story, and phone us for a comment. And if we don't know they're writing that, it's too late by the time it's published. That is very, very difficult. There's not much you can do about that apart from, you know, keep on phoning these people and trying to build bridges.
Sean Jones has described the uphill struggle that there is for the young union press officer of today. You go back further than that, of course, Jeff Martin. Was there a heyday when it was perhaps a little easier for the union's voice, for their voice to be heard?
I think there were more dedicated resources, and I think there was less straightforward editorialising. I think that's the thing. I mean, I'll give you a good example, Nick. I mean, we had a success story quite recently over Network Rail over the Olympics, where we managed to secure over 10% pay increase for our members and a £500 bonus without any industrial action. And yet the media still found grounds to attack us for having achieved a successful outcome without resorting to industrial action. So you kind of think, well, you might as well just have a go anyway. I mean, when I came here, I mean, it was on the pure understanding that we would encounter a relentlessly hostile media. And I've not been disappointed.
Francis Beckett, you, of course, are an author. You've written books on the way in which the labour and trade union movement has sought to present itself. What's your experience then, looking back about what's happening now compared with the 70s and the 80s?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to imagine that we're somehow a golden age sometime or another when decent chaps like Nick Jones were doing industrial reporting and we all had decent coverage, because we didn't. And you've written about this yourself, Nick. Some of the coverage that we saw in 1979, the coverage we saw in 1984, was about as crudely and viciously and mendaciously anti-union as anything that you're likely to see now. But
the FBU, the Fire Brigades Union, was very skillful in presenting itself. I mean, I can remember time and again going to a fire station where the firefighters might be on strike. There would be a brazier burning out there on the roadside. There'd be firefighters standing solemnly there demanding to be reinstated or to get a pay rise. There was no doubt the union was using the pictures to tell the story. So it was possible, despite what Sean and Jeff have just said, it was possible actually to get your message across.
Yeah, it absolutely was. In those days, the union, the newspapers would tend to say, well, it comes from the unions, but it's a good story. These days, they say, well, it comes from, it's a good story, but it comes from the unions. It's a subtle change in emphasis. And I think one of the reasons for that is that although there wasn't a golden age when you were reporting, nonetheless, we were dealing with people who knew a bit about the unions, who understood what we were there for, what we were trying to achieve, who understood why we did what we did, and who knew us. Now, instead of dealing with an industrial correspondent, by and large, we're dealing with city desks. And city desks are terrified of doing anything that is going to upset a share price. And while you're absolutely right, in when you were doing industrial reporting, the Fire Brigades Union, which is sort of clear and disciplined and does the things that are necessary to get good coverage, was succeeding in getting good coverage, massively harder now. Really massively harder, even for the Fire Brigades Union to do that. And we saw that in the strike last year. I've also seen it in dealing with a story about a company called Asitco, which has a contract to own and to maintain all of London's fire engines. The little-known fact, little-known not because I haven't been telling newspapers, but because I really struggle to get it into newspapers, is that Asitco, which is likely to go under any day now, actually owns every single fire engine in London. The fact is, if Asitco goes under, then at least in theory, its creditors own all of London's fire engines and can dispose of them however they will. And since a large number of those creditors are in the Middle East, this could be quite serious. Now, I mean, I'm reasonably good at this. I've been doing this for a long time. I know how to get things into newspapers. I've done everything I know to get that story reported such that you're all looking at me a bit surprised, because I suspect none of you know that story. And that's a measure of the failure that I've had in getting that really quite important story in the newspapers.
Now, Sean Jones, with the Communication Workers Union, you're up against it now, aren't you? Because the postal business, there's a bill going through Parliament, you are facing massive restructuring. What are the sort of tactics, what are the practicalities that you see that you will have to adopt as a union to get your message across in the coming weeks and months?
Well, you're right, there's huge challenges facing the Royal Mail and the UK's postal industry because this government has decided that they're going to privatise the Royal Mail, they're going to flog it off, they're going to do something called mutualisation of the post office network, which nobody really fully understands what it means, including the government at the moment. But, I mean, the media arm of CWU is very much an extension of the industrial policies and the industrial strategies of the union. So we're very much guided by our industrial officers, our general secretary, and we work very closely with the executive on all of the media work that we do. But, you know, it's vitally important to try and educate the public about what's happening.
But you do represent a group of workers who do have a very high recognition factor among the public, don't they? Everyone knows their own post man or woman. We are very familiar with your members, just as when it came to the firefighters, they too had high public recognition. Is that going to make it easier for you? Are you going to be able to find ways in which you can tell the story using the media of today, like television, even though, as you rightly say, you do face this very difficult environment to get your story across?
Yes, absolutely. I think having friendly posties as the faces of your union is incredibly helpful because the British public feels very warmly about post offices and their postmen, because they normally are men,
yes.
who are, you know, cycling and walking up and down every street in the UK. But one of the things that I find really helps to engage journalists is case studies, and we're constantly being asked for case studies. And one of the things that I'm working on at the moment, for example, is to show an example of what has happened under privatisation and full-blown competition in the Netherlands, where the state postal operator TNT has completely gone to pieces, and some customers are only getting deliveries 3 days a week now. Terms and conditions of postal workers has completely plummeted. There's been mass redundancies. There were strikes before Christmas. So I think the kind of personal, the human interest factor about this, you know, this is John the postman. He 5 years ago was earning £16,000. Now, 5 years later, he's earning £11,000 basic. And
there has been that significant cut in wages then?
Absolutely. What they're doing is they're clawing back their core hours. They're kind of rolling that back and trying to get people to be sort of self-employed postal workers. And they'll give them crates of mail in the morning, and they have to go out and say how much they've done. And you know, it's not guaranteed hours. And it's very, it's kind of scary if you're in that industry. And that's coming to a street near you, unless, you know, we can try and get some better protection put into the legislation in the UK.
Right, you can see there's a fight ahead then for the postal workers. Let's look at the rail and the London Underground workers. Jeff Martin, of course, you as the spokesperson for the RMT, the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, you have a general secretary in the shape of Bob Crowe, who has perhaps the highest recognition factor of any union leader in the country. Certainly, I think that would be the case in London. Is that going to prove an advantage to you, as we've just heard from Francis and from Sean, of the difficulties which unions are facing in trying to get the media to report positively what's going on?
I'm not sure it makes a lot of difference, Nick, to be honest. I mean, I suppose every generation has its trade union bogeyman. I remember when Alan Fisher from UP, when I first became a UP activist, and was it Fuhrer Alan Fisher, I think they called him during the Winter of Discontent, Arthur Scargill, and so it goes on. I don't think there's anything new. I mean, the media love a bogeyman. I think what's slightly different is that during one of the tube strikes, maybe probably last summer, the Sun actually turned up at Bob Crowe's house and parked a double-decker bus outside his house and were literally harassing him on the doorstep. I mean, you know, journalists standing on his feet in order to try and provoke a response from him. We've had journalists camped out outside here trying to effectively just stonewall us back into this building. And I think operationally that's slightly different. I'm not sure that happened in the past at that kind of level. They want to dramatise the story in that kind of way. They want to personalise it in that kind of way. And I don't think that makes a huge amount of difference. I mean, some of the successes we've had have been in the teeth of that kind of opposition. I mean, that's the truth of it. We don't go out and say, well, we have to win over public opinion or we can't win this dispute. That's never an issue here. What will win it is the success of our industrial strategy. But I do think another point that's worth chucking in is that the trade union movement in terms of its media operations is incredibly lean. And when I look at the other side of industry and the resources that they will throw at it, somebody gave me this morning a copy of the booklet from Network Rail on their media operation. And I look at it and I think, well, these are the guys that when we're fighting a dispute over cuts on the signalling or cuts on the track maintenance, it's me against them. And they've got teams of people. Plus, they'll bring in external support as well as and when they need it. They've got lobbyists. They've got the whole range and paraphernalia that you would expect. Transport for London have 12 press officers. London Underground, in addition, has 6. The Mayor's office have probably about the same number as well. When we're locked into a dispute on London Underground, it's me against them. So it is tough in terms of the odds, but it does mean that you've actually got to rise up to that challenge. And that's why I think the trade union movement is successful, is because we actually understand what it is that we're trying to achieve. Sometimes you can have too many press officers and they end up getting themselves in all kinds of difficulties by issuing kind of random and different briefings to the media. And I actually find that those journalists who are good like the idea of having one person they can come to actually talk about a situation or a subject. And I think that kind of works for us. But I think in the teeth of all of that, hostile media, unlimited resources from the other side of industry that they can chuck at a story, I think the trade union movement does pretty well.
In a word then, would you say you're ready for what might come? I mean, if we're right, if the indications that are coming, that there could be a level of coordinated industrial action that we haven't seen before, which could perhaps bring in other unions, who knows? Do you think the union movement is ready for
Absolutely.
It?
I mean, the thing that people have got to remember as well, Nick, is that we are membership organisations. Decisions in this building here at the RMT are taken by our grassroots, nobody else.
I mean, Sean was saying that the ballot sort of information
absolutely.
That her union is getting absolutely. Is very solidly absolutely. In favour of strike if it came to it.
But I think that's a strength of the trade union movement, is that we are voluntary organisations. We're membership-based organisations. We're democratic and accountable to our membership base. They take the decisions. As press officers, our job is to implement decisions that are taken by our industrial structures and by our rank and file members. And I think that, in a way, gives us a strength that some of the other side of industry. And if you know, for example, that you've got a 9-1 vote in a ballot for action, it doesn't really matter what the Sun have got to say about that, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't really matter what the Evening Standard have got to say about that. As long as the members believe that what we are doing is right for them, then I think we can win.
Now, before I get your predictions, your final predictions, let's turn the focus towards the journalists, because, of course, we should perhaps, this is certainly what the trade union movement would like, is to see a few journalists in the dock answering a few questions about the way we conduct disputes. Now, Francis, you hover between the two. Much of your life has been as a journalist, as with my life, of course, I believe that part of the change was that, of course, it was a sort of follow-through from the Thatcher years, in the sense that when we had the breakup of the nationalised industries, and as you've both reported and as you've all said, there was a switch in much of the reporting, and it was done by the city correspondents, the finance correspondents, the old Labour and trade union correspondents. We were sidelined. What was your observation on what happened, and what's your advice to the journalists of today then, Francis?
Well, I think, firstly, I'm not actually sure I entirely agree with Jeff about resources. I think that the union movement can do with at least the level of resources that it's got. Now, you and I, Jeff, can remember the time when the unions were saying they didn't need any sort of public relations resources at all. I remember a very well-known union leader, a very famous union leader who I won't name, saying, oh, we're not going to sell ourselves like soap flakes. Well, then, of course, along came New Labour, and the unions suddenly started thinking they had to sell themselves exactly like soap flakes, which was equally mistaken. But I do think that the movement has been right to increase the level of resources that it puts into public relations, and I would like to see it increasing that level further. I certainly found myself, just as Jeff did, really struggling, because there was, in exactly the same way there was Jeff and the massed ranks of the press officers of his opponents, so there was me versus about about a dozen press officers working for the London Fire Brigade, all of them able to contribute, all of them able to try to influence journalists, and obviously they can get round an awful lot more journalists than I could. Not that the journalists required a lot of influencing, which is your other point, Nick. Now, a journalist never goes out on a story with a blank sheet of paper in his mind. There's never a journalist is never sent on a story without somebody knowing what story they are expected to bring back, and the pressure on them to bring back the story that they have been sent out to get is enormous. And to answer your question, Nick, my only advice to journalists trying to cover what's going to be happening, whether it's going to be happening as early as you're saying or later, it's going to be happening over the next couple of years or so. And my advice to journalists covering it is go and see what the story is. And if it's not the story you were sent out to cover, then write the story that is, rather than the story that the news editor thought there was going to be.
Sean Jones, your union is probably closest to the prospect of having significant news coverage, because of course if the government does actually announce who is going to buy Royal Mail, what are going to be the plans for the postal workers, that's going to mean a lot of work for you as the press officer, isn't it, for your union. What's your advice then to journalists of today?
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with Jeff that I think we are working on a bit of a shoestring. However, I think journalists should be coming to trade unions because you're getting it from the horse's mouth. I mean, we never lie to journalists. We wouldn't do that. And I think the authenticity of people's voices that comes from trade unions is unique. And it's a very important story to be told. And you won't get that from anywhere else. You can go and vox pop all you like. You're not going to get the sort of messages that you get from trade unions anywhere else. I mean, there's some really, one of the things that I think when we get, you know, if you're looking at kind of disputes and really difficult coverage that we get, one of the things that kind of annoys me sometimes is the obsession with individual personalities. And I mean, Jeff alluded to this with the sun rocking up on Bob Crowe's doorstep. I mean, we've had, as soon as there's any kind of dispute, journalists will start pulling up General Secretary's pay, and they'll start comparing that to a postal worker or a tube driver. They're not comparing it to the chief executives of the companies that we have those members in, and they should be, frankly, considering the sort of responsibilities and the jobs that the General Secretaries do. So I think the obsession with individual personalities is something that I would like journalists to be less bothered about, and stop doorstepping, you know, my General Secretary when he's trying to run a big national set of negotiations with a huge company. You know, don't be knocking on his door and asking his wife, does he support her, which is what happened last time we had a national postal strike. Don't be trying to, the Express ran a story saying that Billy Hayes had had his mail when nobody else in the country had had his mail, which was just a complete lie, for example. The Sun did virtually no coverage of the national postal strike, other than they managed to find possibly the only postman in the entire country who had a beer on a picket line and did a huge photographic story on it. You know, it's not actually giving an accurate reflection of what's going on. So I think be proportionate. And coming back to the idea about personalities, you've mentioned, you know, is Bob Crowe well known in London? One of the things that, it's just an anecdote really, but I was watching University Challenge last year, and one of the questions, one of the picture rounds was, can you name these four General Secretaries of trade unions? And there was Brendan Barber of the TUC, Paul Kenny of the GMB, Dave Prentice of Unison, and Bob Crowe. And the only name, they tried Arthur Scargill a couple of times, but Bob Crowe was the only one they recognised and the only one they got right, because I think he's got such a high media profile, people recognise him, and it's a very memorable name as well, so that always helps.
Well, look, let's finally look ahead to the changes that are happening within the media world in which we live. Now, we've seen how online insurgencies, for example, the online protest about the government selling, the coalition government selling off forests, halted the government's in its track. Can we see any evidence that perhaps the unions are mobilising online and that perhaps there are going to be new ways in which you can communicate to your members and to the public going over the head of the established media? Jeff, what do you think of the chances?
Yeah, I mean, we do that. We use whatever device we've got at our disposal. We try and get all of our members onto SMS, texting them directly.
But what about Twitter?
Don't do Twitter here. And Bob won't have a Facebook site. There have been several attempts to stick up bogus Bob Crow Facebook sites. I mean, we try to do what actually works for us. So we run, we do our own television broadcast through RMTV. It's kind of guerrilla stuff. I mean, we don't try and sort of replicate Panorama or something like that. We do stuff that we think actually works for our members. We find out what is useful to them. And people do like to know if they're in dispute or if there's an issue coming up, that the union's contacting them directly and telling them about it. And we do find that that actually helps it. Helps in terms of morale of our members, helps in terms of getting the message out into the workplaces. But we are a very lean industrial trade union. I mean, we've got very designated sectors of workers that we organise. And I can imagine for some of the big general unions, it must be very, very difficult to do that in the way that we're able to here. So yes, it's a challenge for us to utilise the new technology. I'm very interested in some of the campaign groups, the online campaign groups like UK Uncut, False Economy, and the way that they're doing their stuff. And I think that is something that we're going to have to make more of an effort to capture. But that's about mobilising public support, but it's also about informing our members, and I think that's absolutely critical.
Francis Beckett, can you see any hope there for the trade unions in the fact that this whole new media environment is opening up, as Jeff has alluded, is opening up new opportunities?
I think that newspapers are simply not as powerful as they once were, and they have not got used to the idea that their power is disappearing. You still find that you are dealing with newspapers as though they think they are arbiters of what is right, that they are setters of the national agenda. And once they were, they're not anymore. The national agenda is... And if unions can harness the internet as a great sort of democratizing tool, then they're doing very well indeed. And I applaud what Jeff is doing with that. I think unions are increasingly finding that in a way that they couldn't before, they can go behind newspapers to their members. The Sun came to me, and this is an anecdote that just a short anecdote that I'd like to close on. They came on the first day of the fire brigade union strike last year with a story saying that our three top officials had claimed some vast sum of money, hundreds of thousands of pounds, in expenses in the past year. It took me ages to work out where they got the figure from. The figure, it turned out, was what the union had paid out over that 12 months for every bit of hotel expenses, every delegate at conference, everything the union had spent on travel, on meals, on trains, on all the rest of it throughout the year. And they had refined that down to the travel, the expenses of the three top officials. Extraordinary operation. They ended up quoting the figure, but quoting me as saying that it was a different figure to the one that they'd said it was in the previous paragraph. So, you know, they stuck as closely as they could to the story they'd started out with, even though it was absolutely wrong. But they are no longer the arbiters of what people think in the way that they were 30 years ago, and that's and therein lies hope.
Well, one would have to counter that by one thought that, of course, the newspapers can still set the agenda, and a lot of the online chatter and the online campaigns, of course, derive from what the newspapers have said. And that gets back to your closing thought, doesn't it?
Increasingly, Nick, it's working the other way round, and the newspapers are having to follow an agenda that is created by bloggers, mostly at the moment right-wing bloggers. But mostly at the moment it comes from the likes of Guido Fawkes or Ian Dale. But there's no earthly reason why that should continue.
Sean Jones, your union, the Communication Workers Union, you're going to be facing big change. Of course, you're at the very forefront of this whole switch from, for example, postal deliveries to the possibility of electronic information and the switch to that. So how is your union in particular facing up to this challenge of finding new ways perhaps to try to communicate?
Well, our General Secretary is a big fan of Twitter. I think he was made for Twitter, Billy Hayes. He puts out one-liners all the time. He loves it. I think it's very much what you feel comfortable with. So, yes, we do use Twitter. We do use Facebook. Our branches are constantly on Facebook. A lot of campaign work gets done over Facebook. Our website is a really important resource and tool for us.
But could you use those techniques to mobilise people? That's the point, I think, that therefore that people aren't affected by the propaganda that we've just been hearing Francis describe, the attempts to vilify trade union leaders. Is it going to be possible to actually use and create those online insurgencies, which we've seen can be very effective?
I mean, we're not going to start being UK Uncut and getting people on the streets for massive demos. But however, I think old media loves new media at the moment, but old media is still influential, less so. But if there was an expose to do with expenses, I had The Sun came to me with the exact same story, and the answer that I got back to them with, they told me it would keep the lions from the door for the moment. So it was quite scary. They never published the story they wanted to about CWU in the end. But it's using a combination of media outlets. So it's the traditional print media, it's the broadcast media, it's you know, going out to bloggers and saying, would you be interested in blogging about this, or finding people to blog on our behalf. And it's direct email communications. We've got a digital magazine that goes out to our members now. So we do have a whole kind of spectrum. Being the communications union, I suppose you'd expect that.
Mm. Well, there we are. We've had an upbeat announcement there about one union general secretary who is top of the league when it comes to Twitter. Perhaps he's got more followers than anybody else. But I'd like to thank the three of you for taking part. Sean Jones, Francis Beckett, and also Jeff Martin. This podcast was produced for the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom by Claire Colley. And you can read more about the demise of the industrial correspondents in a new book that's just come out, The Lost Tribe of Fleet Street, Whatever Happened to the Industrial Correspondents, and copies are available from the CPBF.